It's time for Caffeinated Comics, a lively discussion and debate on comics, film, television, and collectibles, all fueled by the magic of Frappuccinos. Caffeinated Comics is sponsored by Chimera's Comics. Chimera's is your one stop for comic books, graphic novels, hero clicks, Magic the Gathering, and more. Explore the fantastic at Chimera's Comics. Now, here's your hosts, John and Steven.
Thank you, this is Caffeinated Comics. I'm your host, John Clark. With me, as 96% always, is my co-host,
Steven Brown.
And it's a slow morning again.
We have a lot of these.
Yeah.
It's kind of nice.
I had a late night last night, and a late night that I wanted to have. It wasn't like I was working.
It was a good kind of late night.
Yeah, but I'm not. Now it's just the next morning, and I'm just so glad we have the word coffee somewhere in the title of the podcast. But there is a lot going on. First of all, we are gearing up for C2E2.
Yeah. Oh, God. There's a lot I got to do before that. C2E2.
The store will have a booth.
Yeah, we do a booth every year for the last 5 years. There's a lot of not only because we have to get a lot of the stuff ready for what we're physically going to sell at the booth, which is always a trick when you don't have the first appearance of Spider-Man, you know?
Yeah.
It's like we had a really good first convention there because we had that book and we ended
up selling it. Because you made $10,000 as soon as the show opened.
Yeah, before the show opened. We sold it Thursday night. And so we have good books, but we don't have anything that good. So it's always a rush before the convention to put as many sets together, organize as many back issues as we can, get a bunch of dollar books.
Yeah, that's a good question. How do you decide what the theme of the booth is going to be? Because Joe and I always talk about this when we do the little shows.
Yeah.
We'll leave that and we'll go, you know what? That was a Silver Age show. And then the next Joe will go to, like, that was a dollar box show. And it's the same dealers. It's just what they decide to bring for every show.
Yeah, I think for our part, we kind of know what everyone else is bringing just from, like, history of, like, okay, you know, it's pointless for us to bring, like, graphic novels, for example, because there's entire booths from entire stores that just do graphic novels and sell them for, like, 50% off.
Yeah, there's a lot of guys, I don't remember this back in the day, there's a lot of guys that just bring bookcases as their booth.
Right, and there's so many of those guys now that it's not really worth our time to bring any trades. So typically the go-tos for us are always dollar books, which you can always sell. Any Silver Age books, obviously, because, you know, there's only so many of those out there, and every version of it's so different just based on price and condition and such. And then statues and toys, and then, like, anything we just want to get rid of. So, like, the stuff that's been in the store for, like, over a year, we mark it down at the convention. The convention's, like, a good liquidating show for us, where it's like kind of get rid of all this stuff we may be over ordered on. You know, like the Batman the Animated figures sell very well, but I have like a couple penguins left. Mm-hmm. So we'll bring the penguin and mark them for like $20, and then we'll mark them down to $15, and then whatever. It's kind of the same stuff for us every year that we're bringing, but I think it's like we're more limited by what the competition will bring. And like I said, it's, you know, the dollar books is kind of like your meat and potatoes. It's like you can never really go wrong with dollar books, and we have so many of them. If we just sold dollar books, you know, if half of the dollar books we have, it's a good show for us.
Yeah, it's interesting because you guys did not used to be a back issue type of store.
Yeah, and it's one of the things. It's every comic book store, I believe, will eventually become a back issue store. It's inevitable because as soon as you open, before we opened, I had a guy trying to sell me comics. I was painting. We used to have Thor painted in the door at the shop.
Right.
It was the first thing we painted. And while I was painting it in the store, like 3 weeks before we opened, a guy came in trying to sell me like books. And I'm like, dude, I'm not even open yet. Like, I haven't even bought comics yet. Get out of here.
But, like he thought you got the space just started painting a Thor and was like, I hope I get some comics to sell in this store.
Yeah. Flash forward 5 years, and now I have, like, back issues coming out of my ears. So, you know, we bought stuff from stores that have closed. We closed Woodridge, so we have the stuff from the Woodridge store. It's like, we've got books from kind of all over the place.
And you've got books that, like, didn't sell from Diamond.
Right, exactly, the regular stock. So, basically, the trick is just keeping all that shit organized. Do you know, we go back and forth. Should we bag and board them all? Should we not bag and board them all? If they're going to be dollar books, it's not really worth wasting a bag and board on them. So that's kind of the process now, is I've got all these books. I kind of have to mesh them all together, alphabetize them all, and if time permits, which it won't, put them in actual order, you know, like all the Amazing Spider-Mans together, all the Avengers together, instead of just pile of A books. So that's, and I mean, that's just monotonous, tedious, time-consuming stuff. It's just, there's not enough hours between now and C2E2, especially with this like new job I've got and all this running around. It's like, I don't know when it's gonna happen.
Right, you're actually working a job.
Yeah,
as well as owning a store.
My first 9 to 5, Monday through Friday, and it's a struggle. It's a great job. I'm very happy where I'm at, but I don't know when people get like oil changes, and when do the people do their laundry, and how do you grocery shop? It's like, if I just can't book it in the middle of the day, it's like I have no idea how to do this shit. So it's gonna be a good adjustment period for me.
Yeah, wait till you have other people that make you do things.
I know, and that's the concern. It's like I'll never have children. Because it's like, if I was responsible for like a little person, it's like, we have my roommate Brittany, her girlfriend Lainey just moved in, and she brought cats, which is great. Like, I get along with cats. I grew up with cats, but it's like, I have to remember to feed them because Britt and Lainey are out of town for a week. So it's like, oh, that's like a thing I'm responsible for. You can't forget to do it. And typically they won't let you forget. You know, they're very,
right.
As soon as you wake up, they're all over you because they want food. But it's just, I'm adulting, I feel like, for the first time in a long time, and it's a bit of a struggle. But yeah, the conventions are good. It's they're a lot of fun, and we may have talked about this on the show before, but the setup at the convention is actually part of the fun of it, is that it's like you get to kind of drive this truck into McCormick Place
space, into a building, yeah,
onto the floor. You know, they give you beer. I don't know who started this glorious tradition, but they actually have like, who's this, like Revolution Brewing is like, yeah, the green fist for the handle,
yes,
for the thing. They, it's usually them, it's been other people sometimes, but they set up like a little, but essentially like a bar, and they have like two or three options, and you can get as much free beer as you like during setup, and like, it's amazing. And like I said, I don't know how that got started or who thought that was okay, but it's like a fantastic, it's like, it makes the weekend. So typically for the show is always Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Setup used to be Thursday, and then teardown was Sunday, and it's just this long, grueling, nonstop 4 days. Well, now it's, we've done it this way at least, and I don't know how many other people take advantage of this, and thank God, hopefully none of these people are listening to the show, which you typically want people to listen to the show, but hopefully these people aren't. But there is a way you can set up on Wednesday, which we've been doing, like the early setup, and it makes a world of difference. Thursdays, when we used to go into the show, it'd be like this long line outside McCormick Place of cars, all trucks and stuff, people like waiting to get onto the floor to load their stuff, and they only let so many drivers in at a time. They have to unload their stuff, then they have to drive out of the building, then they have to go back and set up the booth. It's like a nightmare. Wednesdays, the setup day we've been using for the last year and we'll use this year, is you get to McCormick Place at like 10 in the afternoon or 10 in the morning or whatever you call it, and there's literally barely anybody there. The only guys inside McCormick Place are the Teamsters setting up the big booths, like Marvel and DC and the other big vendors. And we're like the only retail guys there on Wednesday, and it's awesome. So it's like we go in, we unload the truck, we set up the booth. We don't typically stock anything. We kind of leave everything and throw like a tarp over it, and then we bounce. And it's like from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m., that's all we do. And, you know, there's... I don't think the drinking guys are there till Thursday. But then when we come back Thursday, we don't have to wait in this stupid long, mile-long line to get onto the floor. Our stuff's already there. We just park in the parking lot, walk into the booth, get beverages, and start setting everything up. But that's kind of like the stuff I never want to lose, is that fun, like, behind-the-scenes aspect of it. The shows are fun. They're a lot of work, but they're a lot of fun.
Yeah.
I mean, this podcast got birthed out of that show, C2E2 we went to.
Yeah, because we went to the Starbucks at on the floor of C2E2.
Yeah, that's actually really sweet that they have that.
We had
too,
like two Frappuccinos, and we got like really crazy. We were just running up and down the aisles. We're like, look at that, and look at that, and look at that.
Yeah.
And then I was like, you know what? We could just do this every week.
And we have. We did do it every week.
Yes, we're doing it right now.
We're doing it right now.
Yeah, there is a great feeling to conventions if you've never been on the other side of it. I got spoiled.
Yeah, it's right.
It really did, because you know I published my first comic before I graduated college, so I went right from school to being like at least in Artist Alley, if not having a booth.
Yeah.
And once you're on the other side of it, it's like sometimes I if I can't get tickets, like I don't want to pay for tickets. It sounds really selfish.
It's so selfish, but I'm in the same boat.
But it's like flying first class and not wanting to go fly coach anymore.
Right. It is a come down, and it's like, you know, we did the same thing. The first C2E2 they ever had, we went to, and we were just pitching the Magnificent. And then that convention, I was like, yeah, I never want to pay to, like, come to these things. And lo and behold, like, the next year we had the store, and then we got the exhibitor badges. And it's just like, I don't like waiting in line for things.
Yeah.
And it's like, I couldn't imagine having to wait in the line before a convention. And all this is like super first world problems. But it's just like, it's so nice to just be able to flash the exhibitor badge, walk straight in. You don't have to wait for anything. There's no knuckleheads in the way. And it's like, but it is. It's like, I'm 100% spoiled. It's like, like if the stores, you know, ever closed or anything and we couldn't do the exhibitor's badge, then it's like, if we didn't get press passage for this podcast, I wouldn't go.
Yeah,
you know, it's like I would refuse to buy tickets. And it's a great show. It really is a phenomenal show. I love the show. The days of me paying for it are over.
Right. My favorite thing in the world is to be asked to do a panel, because whenever we're asked to do a panel, I'm like, that means we can go for free.
Right. And like we did with Wizard World.
We did it with Thomas Wizard World Glenn. And I've done TARDIS a couple of times. Yep. And some of the smaller show, we've done ValorCon. We haven't done a ton of... We've never done a panel at C2E2.
No. I feel like C2E2 is kind of like the biggest, so I think that's part of it, right? Is like, we pitched the Stan Lee
panel a few years ago.
Yeah, and it's like, I think at some point, if we're lucky, we'll get it, but...
Yeah, and I used to, when ReadPop first started the New York Con, which was before C2E2... we know those guys really well, and it was when I was doing stand-up, so we would write the blog, and we would do things for the website, and then we would host a stand-up show on, like, the second stage. So there was always kind of something to do to get in.
Yeah.
But there is that really fun feeling if you're there, like, before the show opens.
Oh, yeah.
There's, like, this... It's almost like when you're camping and you wake up and the sun's just coming up and there's like dew on the grass and you're like nothing started yet, but you're there.
Yeah, it's like corny, but it's kind of magical. You know, it's like there is this kind of like trick to being there ahead of time, and you know, it's just like, you know, it's really fancy, it's really nice, and you've got a place to set down your stuff. It's like, I don't know,
that's always really nice to have a place to put your bag.
Yeah. It's huge, and it's just like, you don't really think about it until you have it, and then it's like, if you ever took that away from me, I'd be like, well, where would I put all my stuff and walk around unencumbered?
Yeah.
You know?
And there is that rush when they let the people in, like, you're just kind of milling around, like, everyone's ready to go, and everyone's just kind of standing in their booth, like,
yeah,
maybe you're talking to other dealers, but there's that feeling when, like, they let the lines in.
Right.
And there's just all these fans that are, like, super pumped. It's a little scary in a way.
It is.
Like, you feel like they're just going to, like, run you over.
Yeah, it's a lot like...
especially, like, the first 50 people on that line.
They're the most enthusiastic.
Oh, my God, yes. Yeah.
Well, it's like... it's kind of like the... like in the zombie movies, you know, when like the horde of the zombies runs at you, and you could be anywhere. And this happens every year. You know, typically I'll get to the show about an hour before it opens, give the booth a once over, make sure we're all good, uncover it with the tarps or whatever we're using to cover it. And then the show starts, you know, an hour later. But by that time I'm walking around, I'm looking to see the lay of the land, checking other booths, seeing if there's anything neat. And it's like, you can always tell the second they kind of like, you know, release the hounds, is because it's like, you hear it. You just hear this like screaming, and then it's just like, it's like if the floors weren't carpeted, you'd almost hear like the thundering of many footsteps.
And it's a very positive energy.
Oh,
it's not like drunken soccer riot, but there is that, like, you step back just a little bit.
Yeah, it's awesome. But yeah, it's like a great show. We were talking about it at the shop with a customer the other day, and he had said, you know, he's one of the regular weekly guys, so he's in all the time. And he's like, yeah, you know, I've never been to C2E2. You know, I've been to Wizard World when I was in high school, and, you know, I haven't been to any of the shows in a couple years, but I definitely want to go this year. And I'm like, well, from my personal opinion, it's like, I do prefer C2E2 over Wizard World. I think it's just a better show. The kind of ball's been passed to them. It's like the big Chicago show, but it's just, it's a great time. It's just like, it's if you've never been and you have any interest in this stuff, it's absolutely worth going at least one day. You know, it's a bit expensive. I think it's like 50 or 60 bucks for a day. But it's like I said, even if we weren't doing the behind the scenes stuff, which we are definitely spoiled on, it's a show that's worth doing just because of it's like it's just fun. It's just like I said, there's a lot going on. It's a busy weekend, but it's a fun weekend.
Yeah, and it's really grown over the years. The first year was when I moved here, so I've been to C2E2 since the beginning. Was there any show as big as this before?
No, like I said, the closest was Wizard World, and maybe Wizard World was that big in like the mid to early 2000s. Because I think I was going there in like 2000, 2003, 2004, stuff like this. And maybe those were big then. But it just feels like C2E2 just gets bigger and bigger every year. And, you know, like I said, it's kind of like the premier convention. I don't have a lot of...
Well, in the Midwest, absolutely.
In the Midwest, yeah, I guess that's what I mean.
I feel like it's third. You have San Diego,
yep,
obviously. No one's ever going to dethrone San Diego. And then New York, which is also Read Pop.
Yeah, it's the same guys that do Read Pop. Or, I'm sorry, the same one that do the New York convention run this convention.
Yeah, and there was a lull in New York for a while because New York used to be... When I was growing up and going to conventions like the 80s and the 90s, New York was the big, big show.
Right.
And then in the mid-90s, right when the crash happened, I think it was Creation was doing them. They just kind of collapsed, and then shows disappeared from New York for a long time. Like, I remember being on the floor of New York Comic Con the weekend Jack Kirby died, and that's all anyone talked about.
Yeah.
But there was a period of like 5 or 6 years where there wasn't really anything. It was... The stuff in the city was about the same level as like these shows out here in the suburbs that are like one day and they're like 30 dealers. We used to do these church shows, and like Marvel and DC would show up to these shows in a basement of a church.
That's amazing.
Because it was the only thing going on in town.
Yeah.
And you know, New York was where Marvel and DC were. I mean, DC's moved to the West Coast since. But it was crazy that city didn't have one. And then Read Pop came in. And Read Pop were... initially doing trade shows for books, and then each year it doubled. And when I went to the first C2E2, I was talking to people just online, and they were like, yeah, I didn't know what this was going to be. Is it going to be good? And I was like, if this is anything like New York, this is going to be the biggest convention in the area in a few years. And it absolutely is.
Yeah, it's like I said, as far as the Midwest, I don't have a lot of experience because I've only been to Wizard World and I've only been to C2E2, but you know, it's what's interesting to me is like, I kind of forget every year, and I'm only thinking about it because it's coming up, and I was thinking about it, is like, how many people I know. And it's like the C2E2 is like, it's so weird because it's like, I really can't go, I'm not trying to like toot my own horn or something, but it's like everyone's in the same spot. All my customers are in the same spot. All the guys I've worked with in the last couple of years are in the same spot. All the guys I know through Matt and the different creators and stuff that we've had doing signings and all this stuff. It's like, it's such a massive, and maybe that's part of it, is you see so many people during this one weekend that you normally only see maybe once or twice throughout the year, especially not all in one place. But I think that level of like so much going on just makes it seem a lot bigger than it is. But it's just like, it's, you know, when you talk to the guys that do, you know, convention season, the artists and the writers who do this stuff, and they, you know, they do 30 shows a year.
Right. There's guys that make their living from shows.
Just from shows.
Like they're not even publishing comics.
Right.
Like they're just going and doing sketches for people.
And it seems to be consistently... most people rank C2E2 in like the top five.
Yeah.
You know, Emerald City is supposed to be a really good convention.
Yeah.
You know,
WonderCon's
a big one. Yeah. And it's cool that we do have, you know, like I said, and it comes with having two conventions in town. We have Wizard World and C2E2. The chances of us having a really good show every year is they're pretty high.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like, so you get New York, WonderCon, Emerald City, C2E2, and San Diego is like your big five, I think. But yeah, it's really cool. And then, you know, the reverse of the setup, which we've got, which is really good, is the teardown. Normally, we'd have to do all this stuff Sunday night. After doing the show all day, it's a complete zoo because everyone's trying to get out of there as soon as possible. Then there's the huge line to try to get out. And we'd get back to the shop at like 11 o'clock at night, 12 o'clock at night. Now we can do it on Monday. We're basically Sunday night, we pack it all up. I put all the expensive books in a little box, throw it in the back of my car and take off. And then I come back Sunday, same thing, 10 a.m. We're out by noon or one. There's no one there. There's no line. Mm. It's bing, bang, boom, and we're out, you know? It's so much easier.
Yeah, it's interesting. And, you know, we're at this point where there is a convention every single weekend. So there are, as I was saying, there are guys that make their living from this because they're doing it every week. It's like they're on tour.
Yeah.
They're just on the road. It's just a different city every week and packing up. Do you ever think you could do like an out of state?
No. The only reason I say no is because the C2E2, it's like, that's why we only do C2E2 and we don't do Wizard World, is it's such production. And, you know, I have a second job now. Cal has a second job. Karma has a second job. Scheduling the employees for the weekend just to make sure we have coverage at the store and coverage at the booth, knowing that I can't be at the stores during that week. Cal can't, Karma can't. It's just it's kind of a logistical nightmare. I couldn't imagine trying to do an out-of-state show. And it never occurred to me that that was something people do until, like, the first C2E2 we were doing. Because we were idiots. I'm just, like, a dumb kid. You know what I mean? I'm making this shit up as I go. We went to the marshalling yard where you set up for C2E2. And, you know, we're waiting in line to get our pass to drive onto the McCormick Place building. And we're in line behind a guy. And he just turned around. He's like, "Oh, hey, how's it going, guys? How's it going?" I'm like, "Oh, not bad, dude. You know, what store are you from?" He's like, "Oh, we're from, you know, we're from Camaras. You know, we're South Side here. What about you guys?" He's like, "Oh, we're from Boston." And I'm like, "What?" He's like, "Yeah, we have a shop in Boston." I'm like, "Well, what the fuck are you guys like doing all the way over here?" He's like, "Oh, no, this store, whatever the store in Boston is, this guy's job is just to do the conventions. They have an entire truck that they own. They load it up with all this stuff, and he just drives around the country and does the conventions while a separate crew runs the booth at, or runs their store in Boston."
Yeah, it's like your second store is just on the road.
Yeah, and I think there's a bit of an appeal to that. I like traveling, you know, I don't mind road trips. It's like, I get that could be cool, but I think it's like you have to get to that point, I think, as far as size, where it's like you can dedicate an entire crew to just doing conventions for 6 months out of the years, because it's like convention season starts in like, what, like March and runs until like October, November. It's like, yeah, it's almost the whole year.
There's one every weekend. I mean, they range from large to small, but there's a lot of stores that that the convention is a bigger business than their store.
Oh, absolutely.
The store that I used to go in New York, and I'm still really good friends with them, Silver Age Comics in Astoria, the owner, Gus, was telling me one time that basically the store is a warehouse for their convention stuff.
Oh,
it's like, yeah, we have a diamond account for like the few members that come in. And it's very tucked away. One of the things I love about it, it's like inside a train station.
Oh, that's right. Like, I've always wanted to do like a shop in a train station. Yeah, you know, like a magazine newsstand.
Those big train stations where you kind of walk down a hallway and there's just like little weird businesses.
Yeah.
Silver Age Comics is that. And they've been there 25 years. And then they bought the space like across the hallway. And it's not the shop. That's just for stock because their back room is so full.
That's amazing.
But obviously, as inherent in the name, Gus makes all his money from selling Silver Age books.
Yeah.
You know, they have great stuff on the wall when you go into the store, but the really nice stuff he takes around the road, and he says like the shop is just kind of a placeholder.
Yeah.
And he's making all of his money from conventions. I was there last year and I was looking for an Amazing Spider-Man, because every time I go back to New York, I always stop in the shop. And I was looking for an Amazing Spider-Man. I think it was like 157. It was just like a random 70s issue that I didn't have. And I'm looking through the long boxes and I don't see it. And Gus is like, "What are you looking for?" And I was like, "Do you have a Spider-Man 157? And he goes, "What condition?" And he brings in a short box.
Yeah.
And there's like 10 copies.
That's amazing.
Of Amazing Spider-Man 157. And basically I just went through and picked the price I wanted.
Right. That's awesome.
And then he gave me a deal, but I was just like, "All right, I guess this grade, I'm willing to pay this much for it."
Right.
But but his focus is not what Diamond is shipping to him this week. His focus is buying and trading these books. And the convention is his livelihood.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like I said, it's like, you know, the guys who make it work, it's definitely, there's a hustle to it. You know, that these guys can run around for 6 months and do all these shows and turn a profit and schedule it. It's like I said, the one show we do a year is kind of a handful for us because we're kind of all over the place. I really do have a respect for the guys that can do multiple shows, you know, book the booth, set everything up. It's like the physical endurance to do that week to week to week is astonishing to me.
Yeah, it's a hustle. When I was doing my first book, we did a lot of the conventions, and we were in New York, but we went as far as like Detroit, and we would do all these shows. And there is it's like being a part of the circus.
Yeah.
Because.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. That's a great metaphor.
Because imagine if you had C2E2 every week, but it was in a different place.
Yeah.
So we would keep running into the same people. And like this, I would run into creators that I knew well at that point, and I would be like, where did I see you? And we'd have to mention cities. So there's this kind of dreamlike feeling of like, you're in the same place, you're kind of in the same place, you're doing the same thing, but everything's different.
Yeah.
Because, you know, your booth's in a different place. All convention centers are obviously architecturally different.
Yeah.
Like, you don't know where you're going to eat.
Right.
You know, and so it's this odd feeling. But you start to get used to that feeling of like, okay, this is what the show is like, this is what Friday's like, and this is what Saturday's like, and this is what Sunday's like. And that year or two I did the comic, as I said, that was the time where New York didn't have a big show.
Yeah.
So we were even more motivated to just go out. And I did it, you know, I was like, I think I was like 24, 25. And it was a total hustle. And I knew artists back then who were on books that had to figure out their schedule around convention.
Yeah.
They'd be like, all right, well, I'm not going to get any work done from Thursday night to Monday morning.
Right.
So I got to finish these pages by Wednesday, because it was just it's another part of the business. And yeah, for a lot of people, it still is.
Yeah. It's interesting from, I guess, that like point of view, is it depending on where you are in the hierarchy, I guess, you know, the guys on like the low end, you know, are there, it's like a working vacation, or not a work, it's like a working weekend for them. It's like these guys are flying out to specific conventions to try to sell as many prints or original artwork or what have you that they can, so they can make extra money that weekend. But they're also doing, since you have to remember, all the editorial guys are at the convention too. All the, you know, editors and the, you know, everyone's kind of in one place. So most of the professionals are running around having fucking meetings. So, like, there's a whole convention, like, behind the convention that I think a lot of people forget about. It's like, look, all the Marvel guys are in one place. These guys live all over the country, all over the world sometimes. This is the time where they're working. And from what I've talked to, or the couple different creators I've talked to, is these guys are getting, like, 4 or 5 hours of sleep a night. Because especially some of the artists, they're up doing convention sketches all night, you know, so they can do more in the morning. And, you know, they're selling them for 50, 80, 100, you know, $800 a pop, depending on who they are. And you got
4 or 6 guys in a hotel room.
Right. Yeah. It's just like, it's, there's a definitely a different side to the convention. You know, the convention isn't just the hours the show's physically open. It's the, you know, the parties at the hotel, every single night of the convention. There's bar crawls they set up. It's like, there's so much to do.
Well, that was the one year I went to San Diego. And I was writing for a website, so I had a press pass.
Yeah.
And the convention was only like really half of the experience, because there was 7 different things afterwards that you would be invited to.
Yeah.
You know, and you'd have to choose between
those. You're literally picking and choosing between what you have the time for.
Yeah, at night it was, you're picking parties, that's the way you're picking panels during the day.
Yeah. Yeah, it's that level of busy. Yeah,
that year I had a press pass, so my job then was, okay, I'm going to do these panels, and I'm going to write these articles about these panels. And then at night you're like, okay, well, I'll go to this place, and all these people will be here. And I remember, I remember some of the guys I was working on the website with, like, one night they were like, we're all gonna go see Step Brothers, which was out at the time, and I was like, why would you go to a movie?
Yeah.
Now it's like, go to a movie when you go home.
It's like, and this is probably something I got from my parents, is like, when we were kids and we go on vacation, I'd always be like, oh, I want to go see that movie. We'd pass like a movie theater. My mom would be like, we're on vacation. Like, why the fuck would you go see a movie while you're on vacation? And it's like that same mentality of like, yeah, during the convention, it's just like, you could go see Step Brothers literally, you know, there's a 6-week window to go see that movie before and after the show. You don't have to see it the weekend you're doing all this crazy running around.
And you're literally choosing between seeing Step Brothers or being at a party with Bruce Campbell.
Yeah, it's just like, it's kind of a no-brainer.
Which is what I did.
No, see, there you go.
Yeah, it is this odd kind of life. And, you know, God bless the people that do it. I mean, we've talked about this. Even if you're A-list, like, comic guys tend to have, like, a 10-year window.
Yeah.
Like, you know, for the most part, unless you're, like, a Jim Lee or a Joe Quesada or a Jeff Johns or Stan Lee, where you figure out your way to becoming one of the
management, essentially.
Yeah, manage the company. If you're just doing books, you know, you're in fashion for like 10 years tops.
Yeah.
You know, Chris Claremont was the top guy from really the 80s, you know, but when the 90s came around, people didn't notice him. So a lot of those guys, we were talking about this when Bernie Wrightson passed away. A lot of these guys, like, the convention is their livelihood.
Yeah.
Because they can connect with these people that grew up with them that would love original art by this person.
Yeah.
And that's kind of life you live. And I always wonder how actors feel about it. Because, you know, every convention is autograph signings, is like, you get these guys. And, you know, Wizard World will get Patrick Stewart to be at a convention. You know, it's not.
Yeah, I mean, they're definitely getting A-list talent. You know, it's like, say what you will about, like, the kid from The Walking Dead. That kid was at the convention and, you know, they pay to fly that kid out. They pay him for the weekend. They probably put him up in a hotel. He's got a food voucher. You know, even like some of the bigger artists, like we've talked about, like Oliver Copiel before on the show. It's like that guy gets paid to fly out. He has to go to his meetings and stuff. They give him a drink voucher. They give him a food voucher.
Yeah, because his name and his face is on all the promotion the convention does.
Because he's doing
Siege. Come to the convention, here's Oliver Copiel.
Right, he's our A-list guy.
He's selling the tickets for the convention itself.
Right, his artwork is the image on the ticket, you know? And, but yeah, it's like there is that higher level to it of like you said, these guys that, you know, they're going and they're making just like a silly amount of money during the convention, because not only are they being paid to be there, they're selling all their original artwork. They're doing this. They're doing this. It's like they have all this other kind of revenue streams, you know?
Yeah. You look at Neil Adams. Neil Adams has a huge booth at every convention.
Yeah.
And one of the artists I used to work with, now basically his job is doing sketches at Neil Adams' booth. You know, he's not Neil Adams, but
he works for a Continuity Studio.
He's working with Continuity, and there's enough people coming up and getting sketches from him that's what he does.
Yeah.
You know, he's not working on a book. He's home during the week, and he works the weekends, basically.
Yeah.
So it is crazy. And as we were saying before, it's a totally separate energy than when you go as a fan, you know, and I mean, it's not a VIP treatment, like I said, unless you're Patrick Stewart or William Shatner coming to this. But it's a completely different experience than it is if you just get a ticket and you just go.
Right. Yeah, and like, you know, it's definitely, like I said, we've talked, it's worth going. It is a really fun show, but it's like I said, there is that extra level to being behind the scenes that's really good or really enjoyable. But, yeah, I mean, it's like a hoot. You know, it's like I have a lot of fun at these shows. It's one of those things where after it's over, I'm like, oh, fuck, thank God that's over.
Right.
But it's like before it's like there is this excitement, and it's like, you know, it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's exhausting.
It is exhausting. It really, really is. But, you know, but it's a good time. And like I said, it's like a good opportunity just to, you know, there's a lot of guys from out of town that we don't get to see all the time. You know, I got the boss I used to work for is down in Florida, so we see him during the convention. You know, it's just there's never a dull moment at these conventions. It's like you're on your feet all day. It's like it's constant.
Yeah. What's your favorite memory from the 5 years of C2E2?
Honestly, it's like the walking around stuff that I really like. I don't see this like the kind of like the trade-off of this kind of stuff is now that I'm on the other side, I used to go to the conventions to look for like back issues and do shopping and look for stuff.
Right.
Now it's like I just like walking around the convention and not having to do stuff. But yeah, it's like, honestly, the booth setup's a lot of fun because, you know, you're drinking, and then the walking around stuff's fun because you don't have to work. You know, it's like, it's basically just look at all this fun stuff there is. And it's like, I don't do too much. I don't like get in for like celebrities or something. Like, I don't care about, they're all lovely people, but I wouldn't wait in line to meet anybody. It's just, no, like, I like walking around and looking at the other booths. When we saw that artwork, that's one of the things I always try to make an hour or two for, is the Albert Moy, and there's another guy. They're like the big two original art guys at the convention every year.
Like selling original
pages. And they sell the original pages. And, you know, now we have those. We've talked about them constantly on the show. Those artist edition books are phenomenal. But
yeah, well, again, that's how we got started. I think it was Albert Moy had an entire John Byrne Fantastic Four issue of original art, and then we were both so excited to look at it, and then that's the age we're living in. Flash forward 3-4 years, and there's a book of that stuff.
Yeah, and it's, that book is a long time coming. I mean, I think we've both kind of knew in the back of our heads that was something that we would have always wanted, and it's great that they're finally making them. But yeah, I think the originally, that was the only way you could see this stuff in person. It's like the real physical pages. It's just like, there's a very large disconnect between the physical comics that you read and then the artwork. It's just like, to see them kind of together, it's just like, it's awesome. Right.
Well, I had no idea how much detail was lost when it gets printed.
Yeah, especially, like you said, the newer reproductions are so much better, but it's like, especially that older stuff, it's like you said, we were looking at this issue of John Byrne's Fantastic Four, and, you know, it's like, I don't know if anyone's read this, if you haven't read that run, go for it right now, it's awesome, but there's a specific issue where they go to, like, this giant space guy, to like, he dwarfs Galactus, and, like, Black Bolt's there for some reason, I can't remember why, but, like, you're seeing all this stuff in the artwork, and I'm like, I read this fucking story, and it didn't look this good, and it just kind of shows you how much is lost in the reproductions.
There's a double splash page in that John Byrne book, which is the Fantastic Four in Latveria.
Yes, I know exactly the image you're talking
Doom's
about.
Doom's on one side and the Fantastic Four's on the other, and they're facing off. And it's, they look really good, but I didn't know until I was looking at that artist edition how detailed the buildings were. I was like, every single window is completely detailed. And, you know, back then in the early 80s when that was printed, that just crushed down into like inky blackness.
Yeah, and it still looks good. It's just there is a large or a fair amount of it that just, it just, like I said, back in the day, just it just got lost.
Yeah, I think that's why a lot of guys get faster as they get older. You know, so
it's like they kind of know what to leave out almost.
Yeah, they start to realize how much effort they're wasting. You know, when you're getting in, you're trying to show off in every single panel.
Right. And then it's just like, yeah, it's like the, you kind of, it's, there is a good give and take, you know, to learn, all right, well, I don't have to do every single window in this building. You know, it's like you a couple lines will do it.
Yeah. And the older guys get more stylized and they get faster because they're only doing what you need to do to tell the story. But you're right. Up until recently, a convention was the only place you would see that stuff.
Yeah.
And it's still, I mean, conventions were originally designed to bring fans together because there was no internet. You know, there were magazines and fanzines, and it was like one guy editing a, you know, a 8-page pamphlet with a Xerox machine.
Like, who was the guy that used to do the original? The Paul Levitz did the original fanzine, right?
Yeah. One of them. Roy Thomas,
all those guys.
Started, a lot of guys who broke into the industry in the 70s and 80s started off doing fanzines. But it was the only way you could meet people. And now we're at an age where the internet does so much of it. You know, we've had people on the show that I have never met in person, not even at a convention, because I got to know them on Twitter or I got to know them on Facebook, and we had a couple of conversations that I'm like, do you want to Skype?
Yeah.
And then they came on. It used to be you didn't even know what creators looked like.
Yeah.
You know, you would go up to a booth and you'd be like, really, that's the guy who, like, and you'd have a completely different picture in your head.
Right. Yeah. That was always interesting to me, is when I started watching, they do it from time to time. They don't do it as often as I'd like, but when they used to do the DVDs, the DC animated movies and stuff, they would always do like extras where they'd interview all the creators. Yeah. And Super Friends, when that was on DVD, Geoff Johns and Mark Waid did a lot of interviews.
That's one of the best sets.
It's challenges the Super so Friends good sets. To see these two guys, because they're basically, you know, super fans of this stuff and they've written these characters, and hear them talk about like The Flash and Captain Cold in the same context as like Super Friends and all that other stuff, and how you can see the impact this had on them and their careers. It's just really cool to see, and that's how I got to know what some of these dudes look like. That's how I know what Mark Waid looks like, and Geoff Johns and all these other guys. And now it flash forward the 20 years it's been since that DVD came out, and these guys are, you know, Geoff Johns is all over stuff for Green Lantern movie and the DC behind the scenes stuff, and you know, it's like we're much more the curtain's kind of been lifted, you know? It's right. Like, we know the guys who are making this stuff. It's not like, you know, 70 years ago when they barely had credits in comic books to search who was drawing them or inking them, you know, and then Marvel kind of came along and gave everyone little personalities and little nicknames and stuff, and it's just like, that was a step forward, and I think that, you know, this veil has been kind of lifted. You can see this behind-the-scenes stuff. It's just really cool to see. And you know, like I said, for, you know, we're lucky, I think, you know, like you got to go to a lot of these things through press or Artist Alley or whatever in the comics that you were working on, and then me with the store and everything, and the couple times we've done it with the podcast, which has been great. But I think this is a good way for like the average non-industry person to kind of rub shoulders with like these industry guys. You know, it's really, really it's just like they're great shows. It's just like there's a lot of nonsense that goes along with them, but it doesn't come close to outweighing like the cool the fun of it, you know?
Yeah, and it's interesting because with a big show like this, people come in with their own different agendas. You know, some people, as we're saying, some people are looking to meet creators, some people are looking to shop, some people are just looking to get together. Cosplay has become so big over the last few years, and conventions,
it's a huge part of it. Yeah,
conventions are where they happen, because people spend weeks and months on these costumes, and you can take a picture and put it on Instagram,
right?
But to actually go out and be seen in three dimensions and meet other people that are cosplaying, because that's become a whole.
And a lot of it too with that, with the cosplay specifically, is like the competitions. This is like the same thing. These people are networking. The 501st, like, you actually have to join the Stormtrooper people, and you have to have certain quality levels, and you have to build the thing yourself, and the quality has to be up to snuff, and it has to look like they did in the movies. It's just like, it is this whole separate like industry to it. You know, that's like, it's like kind of this, it's like part of the joys of the convention or whatever you want to call it. It's this bringing together of people, you know, like Lisa and Tina have done like cosplay before at the conventions. The one year they did the Killing Joke, where Lisa dressed as like Joker in a Hawaiian shirt.
Right. Yeah.
Tina was Barbara Gordon with like the spilled coffee and the bullet wound.
I believe we had a picture of that on our Facebook page.
I think we do. Yeah. And that's something that's really cool, is like, you know, one of the things after the convention I like to look for is they'll post an article and be like, the best cosplay from C2E2. And it's like all the different people you saw and some of them you missed, you know, and it's just like, you know, it's like you'll be at the convention. It's like, this doesn't happen anywhere else. You're at the convention, you're working, you're talking to people, and then you look over and there's this huge, circle of people, because a guy in like a 12-foot-tall Optimus Prime suit is walking around with like noises and sounds and like smokes coming out of this thing, and it's just like these completely ridiculous things. It's a lot like Disney World or whatever you want to call it. You know, it's like you're in this like magical place for
this. But it's like a crowdfunded Disney World.
Yeah, and it's just like everyone's kind of like coming together. It's like you said, it's like it's a bit of a circus. But that's part of its charm, is that that's like this like hodgepodge of all these different things fitting together into this like one kind of like concise idea of what, you know, a show is supposed to be.
Yeah, I think I mentioned it before, but I remember there was one year at C2E2 where in front of the main entrance, so you'll find a lot of cosplayers. A lot of them, they'll be the first thing you see. And there was one year where I was in front, and I think I was talking to you, and the Sinister Six just spontaneously appeared.
Yeah, it was amazing.
And I was looking at them, I was listening to them talk to each other, and it was clear they didn't know each other.
Yeah.
They didn't plan this out. They didn't call each other and be like, all right, I'm going to be Kraven, you be Vulture,
yeah,
and Joe's going to be Dr. Octopus. It was just those six guys in those outfits looked at each other and went, hey, we're the full team.
Yeah, and I think that's cool to see is, you know, like you said, it's you get, you know, you see like videos online where they'll take pictures and they get everybody at the show they can find who's dressed as Spider-Man and like a big Spider-Verse picture. And that same thing is like, you know, you walk around and you see a guy dressed as the Vulture and you're dressed as Mysterio. It's like, okay, come with me. I know where a guy who dressed as Kraven is. Let's try to find the Sinister Six. And it's like a fucking little scavenger hunt for these guys. And, you know, like I said, it's just really cool to kind of see it. Those like magic moments that kind of happen during these shows, you know?
Yeah, and it still happens. I find it interesting that I was thinking about how we're spoiled in a lot of ways these days. With, you know, right now as we're talking, we're both looking through a pile of Minimates.
Yeah, it's a sickening amount of Minimates.
I believe there's, 75 Minimates on the floor right now. They're only X-Men.
It's just, and it's not even all X-Men. There's more than they've made, right? This is only the ones you've got.
Yeah. I don't have everyone, but, and there's like X-Force and some new mutants in there. But growing up, like, I wanted a Wolverine figure and they didn't make one until I was like 12. Like, yeah. We have all this stuff.
And like, now it's like there's like thousands of Wolverine action figures.
Yeah. And it's like we were talking about the original art. It's like you could go to a convention and see original art. But now we even have these books you can buy. But what the trade-off of that is stuff is so much more expensive now.
Yeah.
You know, it used to be like I wanted a Wolverine figure. When they finally made him, he was $4.
Right.
Now he's $22. Yeah. And he's much, much better.
Yeah. The quality, don't get me wrong, the quality is night and day. You know, I had the original brown suit Wolverine action figure. Was like mask came off.
Oh, yeah.
He had the one claw that came out of his. And now it's like you look at the one we were playing with last week here, mm-hmm. where it's like the Marvel Legends and like the claws are actually like could separate a little bit on his hands. And it's like he's super poseable. It's like they look so awesome now. But it's like, yeah, now it's, you know, eight times as much to buy right. it.
Yeah. It's interesting how it's evolved and yet it's a little less mainstream because comics, I was just reading a comic and I didn't like it this week. And it was part of a crossover that I wasn't interested in reading. And I was like, well, I don't want to skip an issue.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'll just buy it. And I'm reading it and I'm not enjoying it at all. It's not even worth saying.
All right.
But then I looked at the cover and it was $3.99.
Oh, God.
And I was like, oh, my God, I spent... Because I don't even think... I come into your shop, and you hand me books, and then you tell me what they cost, and I buy them, and I walk out.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not budgeting when I'm getting it, because I don't even buy that many comics a month, so the comics you pull for me, I'm going to buy.
Right.
But I realized I paid $3.99 for this book that took me 5 minutes to read, and I didn't enjoy 1 second of those 5 minutes. And I started to think how... The comics I used to read were 60 cents.
Yeah.
You know, so it's this odd trade-off where they used to be 60 cents a dollar and they used to make a million copies of these books sometimes.
Right.
And now it's like, as we were saying, now it's like, you know, 20,000 and it's $3.99. So you can get exactly what you want now. But you're
paying for it.
You're paying premiums for
and
it
it's,
all over.
You know,
yeah.
we talked a little before the show, and that's actually a pretty good segue. If that was deliberate, good job, John. Recently, Marvel came out with their sales were down this year. 2016, I guess, or last year, I should say. 2016,
yeah, the second half of 2016, they said it was
like
down.
Bombed. And one of the editors or somebody, I didn't read this article, so maybe you can clear this up if I've got misinformation here. But one of the guys had said, well, yeah, you know, the reason sales were down was because, you know, Marvel's done so much with like the diverse characters that that people don't care about female Thor or Sam Wilson as Captain America. You know, that's why this summer, I guess Marvel's returning to like, they're bringing the Hulk back. They're bringing back Wolverine because the all-new Wolverine is his X-23 clone lady. And they cited diversity as the reason that these books were tanking, was that they have all these like female or minority characters. And it was just like, no, it's not, you fucking idiot. It's just like all those books, the female Thor book is selling fantastic for us. The Ms. Marvel book is selling fantastic for us. The Sam Wilson Captain America and the Steve Rogers Captain America books are both selling really great.
So what's bombing?
It's the fucking events are bombing. It's they're coming out with 16 events a year. Monsters Unleashed, Civil War 2. No one gives a fuck about these events. And the number one complaint I was getting from my customers is that the books keep getting rebooted. You know, they'll get 12 issues and then they reboot it back to number one with the exact same creative team. And it's like, we talk a lot about this show. I take a dump on like producers of movies and things like this. And it's the guys that take away the wrong message. It's like they're not aware enough of what the real message is. This happened with Deadpool. Deadpool was a really successful movie. And I believe the reason it worked is it was true to the character. They didn't have some ridiculous budget. And it was like a sensible movie as far as it was true to the character. They knew what they were doing. The people that worked on the movie understood the character and they were able to get it right. And part of understanding it and getting it right was making sure that movie was rated R. Well, then Fox makes that movie and it makes up a bunch of money for them. And they're like, oh, yeah, the reason this movie did so well is because it was rated R. All the X-Men movies from now on are going to be rated R. And it's like, no, you fucking idiots. Deadpool can be rated R. Wolverine could be rated R. Maybe X-Force should be rated R. But it's like don't make an X-Men movie where Cyclops is like blowing people's heads off.
Right.
And I think that was their takeaway. It's the same thing with DC with, oh, well, you know, Batman did really well, but Superman tanked. So we've got to make everything like Batman. Everything's got to be dark. And it's like, no.
And they're talking about making their movies rated R.
Yeah. And it's just like, they're completely missing the mark on this stuff. And I think that's what's happening with Marvel with this stupid statement this idiot made was like, well, it's our diverse characters. And it's like, no, it's event fatigue. It's renumbering of books. It's jacking the prices on books up to $3.99 when they should be $2.99. There's no new content. And it just seems like these guys who are in this industry, well, any industry really, just have a really hard time putting their finger on or figuring out what the reasons for some of these problems are.
The greatest thing in the world.
This week.
So this week I actually made time for this. There's a book I've been waiting to read for a really long time, and I heard about it back when the New Frontier animated DVD came out. Darwin Cook was doing an interview, and he was talking about his approach to the story, but why it was set in the time he set it in and why he kind of treaded through that. And he said, well, you know, anytime you want to do a Justice League story, you don't want to do the same thing somebody else did. And he said Mark Waid had done a really good job with JLA Year One, the first couple days, the first couple adventures of the Justice League. It was a really good story. And he said, so he couldn't do the first team up of the Justice League. So he went a little bit ahead of it or behind it to do like all these guys first kind of getting started in the Silver Age. And he said the story he wanted to piggyback off of was a story James Robinson did called JSA the Golden Age.
Yeah.
Did you read that?
Yes, I did.
I just got it. He had mentioned it in this interview and talked about how, you know, this McCarthyism type era, he wanted to set his story in between JSA the Golden Age and Mark Waid's JLA Year One. And he came up with a New Frontier, which is a really beautiful, great story we've talked about many times. But so I had read JLA Year One, but I'd never read JSA The Golden Age because I don't care about JSA. So I went looking for it when that DVD came out, and it was out of print. DC wasn't printing it. Well, they just re-released the book in a hardcover I picked up maybe 2 weeks ago and got a chance to sit down and read. And it was really good. It's a great just JSA story. You don't have to know anything about these characters going in. And it's like it starts kind of like right at the end of World War II. They don't do much with the war, but it's like the kind of aftermath. It's like the last days of the Justice Society, essentially, with these like superheroes kind of in like forced retirement and all this like McCarthyism stuff going on. And they had like some surprise villains that were really great. It's like, there's a good reveal at the end that I was super caught off guard by, just an excellent, excellent story. And it's one of those ones where it's like, you know, this was written 20 years ago, probably, or 15 years ago at the latest.
Yeah. I think it's like mid to late 90s.
Yeah.
That's when I read it.
Yeah. You, when it came out probably, right?
Yeah, I read the trade, but I think a friend of mine had the trade right when it came out.
Yeah, and like I said, it's a great book. It's one of those kind of gems of like, oh, cool, here's the like undiscovered story to read that I hadn't read. And they just did a really, really cool job with it. And I was a little confused because I don't know where this takes place in, but there's an instance where like Green Lantern Alan Scott Green Lantern is like in Japan when Hiroshima goes off, or there's some kind of story with him in Hiroshima, and they touch on it briefly in this book. And I think that's kind of like the next thing I'm going to look for, is where that story is that I've heard about or I've read about. But it's just kind of nice to have this like gap filled in of like, you know, you hear about this great story, it's out of print, and then DC finally reprints it, as they will pretty much anything. And it was a really, really sweet one-off story. It's kind of like, you know, if Hollywood could ever get their shit together, you want to make a JSA story, this is the book to base the movie off of. You know, it's like, it was just kind of just a really sweet little story.
Yeah, I do remember really enjoying it. And it was like fairly deep and quiet, and said it really does set the template for New Frontier.
Yeah, it is. I always, my buddy Stuart had a line. He said that New Frontier is the alpha and Kingdom Come is the omega of the DC universe. That's the beginning and the end. And this story is the only story so far that I know about that I would read before that, because it just extends it by a couple years. And you kind of get this feeling like, yeah, there was this golden age, this generation of heroes that comes before. And it's like builds on that kind of like legacy of like, here's the, you know, the original Flash retired. It's like our man's, you know, addicted to the miracle pill. And like that kind of starts off New Frontiers, or not Owlman, Hourman. But yeah, it's just a really, really cool story. I highly recommend it. Like I said, it's finally back in print. If you can find it, go for it. You know, single issues or, you know, half price books might have it. We've got the hardcover at the store, but it's a great, great story.
Yeah. My greatest thing was kind of a news item was Don Rickles passed away this week at the age of 90. So it wasn't really a tragedy. It wasn't like a Robin Williams sized tragedy, but I immediately like felt bad about it. And all weekend I've been pulling up YouTube clips of Don Rickles, and we were talking about him, and you were like, who is he? He was a comedian. And I was like, oh, he's Mr. Potato Head in Toy Story. And you're like, yeah. Oh, that guy. And I'm like, but there was so much more.
Yeah, yeah. I'm like, a terrible, like, cultural person. You know what I mean? I don't know shit about anything.
Yeah, but he was, you know, he's been around since the 60s, but he was the original insult comic.
Yeah.
And, you know, almost no material. He would just come out and just start insulting everyone and in a very disarming way. And watching his clips now, at this age where we're so much more politically incorrect,
yeah,
his stuff is more shocking. His stuff from the 60s is more shocking now,
yeah,
than it was even then. So I was watching these clips. He did a lot of the Dean Martin roast. There were a lot of clips of him just like trashing other celebrities. A lot of appearances on Johnny Carson, where he would just insult Johnny to his face. But what I loved about him is every time he was at like a big showbiz thing. There's a great one where he's in, he's at the Lifetime Achievement Award for Shirley MacLaine, and he just gets up and he's just insulting everyone around him, like Clint Eastwood.
Wow.
And one Ben Julia Roberts, he looks at Julia Roberts, he's like, Julia, you live two blocks away from me, you never come over. And she was like, I live closer than you. He goes, you don't have any lines, just nod. and like, but when he does that, the way everyone laughs,
yeah,
it's not a showbiz polite laugh. It's not like, oh, very good, like a talk show laugh when you have a panel on a talk show,
yeah,
and somebody makes a joke and they're like, that's a great joke. There's like, you can see it hits people in the gut,
yeah,
and it's that kind of laugh they can't control, and it was so disarming, especially when he would attack other celebrities, because they said he was the only guy who had the guts to like make fun of Frank Sinatra to his face.
Yeah.
And there's clips and Frank just loved it.
Yeah. You know?
And it was all like, he would just do mob jokes to him all the time. Mob jokes and old jokes. He was like, it's one clip where he's like, Frank, today you're 65 years old. And I got to say, you look it. But like, it would just hit them so hard that he was so naturally funny.
Yeah.
And just such a force. And the other thing I noticed is that not only were the laughs so genuine around him, but nobody ever tried to upstage him.
Yeah.
Everyone around him just like...
It's like they've deferred to him almost.
They just leaned back and let him go.
Yeah.
It was kind of like watching Robin Williams when Robin Williams would just like riff on a show. And
yeah.
Nobody would ever like... Nobody would try to tag his jokes.
Yeah.
Or get in front of him or be a straight man to him. They just
you just take the leash off.
Yeah. Know? So there are a lot of really, really great clips. If you just YouTube Don Rickles, you're going to see like just the stuff from the 70s and 80s. And like Steven, if you only knew that he was in that he was Miss Potato Head, or that he was
in
Casino.
But that same kind of like comedy that they obviously toned down for Toy Story, but like that same kind of characters, like he's kind of got a chip on his shoulder. Yeah. He's kind of, you know, going after everybody.
Well, and you can tell in 2 and 3, it's written for him. So yeah, it's written to be in his voice, just like anger in Inside Out is written
Lewis
to be
Beck,
Lewis Black.
Yeah,
yeah, but honestly, we found they gave Don a Lifetime Achievement Award on like Spike TV like 2 or 3 years ago. The entire thing is on YouTube, and it's huge. It's like one of those Kennedy Center Honors kind of things, and they did it at the Apollo. But the lineup of people coming out and honoring him, it's like David Letterman, Tina Fey, Amy Poehler, Tracy Morgan, Jerry Seinfeld, Jon Stewart.
Yeah.
Bob Newhart was his best friend. Bob Newhart did something. Just this outpouring. He was a guy like a George Carlin, where just he was such a touchstone of comedy. And I tweeted when it happened that my friend Jamie Mattern, who's a really, really great comic in New York, he's a guy that like hosts everybody's shows. And he's a guy that came from Vegas. He was living in Vegas and moved to New York. So he came to this area where everyone's like an alt comic. Like everyone's kind of like a hipster comic.
Yeah.
You know, they're all reading their notes on stage. They're mumbling monotone. They're pacing back and forth. And one night it drove him crazy. We were leaving some terrible show. And he's like, I don't know about these comics, man. All I know is if you don't have Don Rickles' Hey Dummy on CD and you don't have Red Foxes, You Gotta Wash Your Ass, you are not a comedian. And every time I listen to Hey Dummy, which was this album he did in the 60s, where he has no material. It's just like a Vegas club.
Yeah.
Where he's just making fun of people you can't see. And it's just so hilarious. And every time I see that, I think of him. So I tweeted him immediately. You honestly can't go wrong.
Yeah.
But if you want to follow me, I'm at Not In My Book on Twitter. I'm tweeting things about Don Rickles. If you want to see now, you can follow the page on Facebook, facebook.com/caffeinatedcomics, where we post all our news. Posted the bad lip reading of Star Wars Force Awakens this week, which is one of the funniest bad lip readings I've ever seen.
I saw it and click on it. Is it?
It's so good. Mark Hamill is doing Han Solo in it, and it is the greatest Harrison Ford impression I have ever heard.
Wow.
The whole video, I'm like, Harrison Ford didn't really do this. You can't get Harrison Ford to do this.
Yeah, but like, you can get Mark Hamill to do it.
And there was just one phrase which sounded just a little like Mark Hamill. And then they give him a credit at the end. It's hilarious.
Wow. Okay, I'll have to check that out.
Yeah, and then you can follow the show on iTunes or on Stitcher, or just go to caffeinatedcomics.blogspot.com. You'll get every episode for free. And Steven, sometimes you're...
Yeah, it's going to be rarer and rarer. Good luck finding me at 19 South LaGrange Road in LaGrange, Illinois.
Caffeinated Comics is a Not In My Book production.
Take that, meatball!